Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the City of Arroyo Grande. This is our city council meeting for Tuesday, February 11th, and this evening, the council will also be meeting as the housing successor agency to the dissolved Arroyo Grande Redevelopment Agency. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Barnett?
Here.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Here.
And Mayor Farrar?
Here. Item 3 is our flag salute, and we're very pleased this evening to have Girl Scout Troop 41049. And they are here to lead us in the flag salute. This looks like a brownie troop. No, they're Girl Scouts. Come on up, ladies. It's okay. We won't bite you. Okay.
On our behalf, we pray for our law and fire professionals to show love in their respectful and careful responses to the needy and to the hurting. Please protect our police, protect our firefighters, our public works guys, our recreation and children's leaders, and our residents, regardless of ages or income. Lord, lead tonight's meeting with your loving wisdom. In your precious and holy name we pray. Amen.
Thank you, Pastor Randy. Do we have a microphone for these young ladies? So I need to ask you, did somebody tell you what the drill is tonight? If you do our flag salute, we get to hear about all the fun things that you've been doing. All right? And we're waiting to hear. So what are some of the really nice, fun things that you've been doing?
We have been learning about water, and we have been selling Girl Scout cookies, and we have been doing things to earn our badges, and we have, earlier today we did something to get to know each other, and that's pretty much it.
Okay. Anybody else want to say a few words? There we go.
We also got our yellow key, and it's locked.
Oh, okay. And what else? Okay, anybody else have any fun things they want to share? Come on now, don't be bashful. This is your chance.
Raising any of their hands.
Is that it?
I think so.
Okay. All right. Well, we appreciate you being here tonight, and it was really great having you. And will you come back and do our flag salute again for us? Is that a yes?
Yes.
Oh, okay, good. All right. Well, we'll look forward to seeing you the next time. Thanks so much for being here. Okay? Okay. Very good. Okay, very good. Moving right along, we're on agenda item 5, and that is agenda review. 5A is closed session announcements. We have none this evening. 5B, move that all ordinances presented for introduction or adoption be read in title only, and all further readings be waived.
So moved. Second.
We have a motion and a second. Discussion? Hearing none. All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion carries. Item 6 is special presentations, and we have two this evening. The first is an honorary proclamation recognizing February 25th, 2014, as World Spay Day. And I would invite Mary Buhner Kemper, is that correct? If you would please meet me at the podium. Mary, it's a pleasure to present this to you this evening, and this is a proclamation. I'm going to read just a few of the whereases. This is an honorary proclamation recognizing February 25th, 2014 as World Spay Day. Whereas pets provide companionship to more than 71 million households in the United States, and whereas humane societies and animal shelters have to euthanize millions of animals each year, many of whom are healthy and adoptable, due to a lack of critical resources and public awareness. And whereas the problem of pet overpopulation costs the taxpayers of this country millions of dollars annually through animal service programs aimed at coping with the millions of homeless animals. And whereas spaying and neutering has been shown to dramatically reduce the overpopulation of pets. And whereas veterinarians, national and local animal protection organizations, and private citizens work together to ensure that spaying and neutering of more than 49,000 pets through World Spay Day in the United States in 2013. And whereas veterinarians, national and local animal protection organizations, and private citizens have joined together again to advocate the spaying and neutering of pets on World Spay Day 2014. Now, therefore, be it resolved that I, Tony Ferrara, Mayor of the City of Arroyo Grande, on behalf of the City Council, do hereby proclaim February 25, 2014 as World Spay Day, and we encourage the citizens of Arroyo Grande to observe the day by having their own pets spayed or neutered.
A difference. We're at least making a difference for those animals that we are touching. But we're still really up against public apathy, puppy mills, and pet stores that are selling animals that are unfixed. Someone buys a $200 kitten, but then can't afford to get it spayed or neutered. Next thing you know, Fluffy has four or five. Groups like ours we're not the only solution. It has to have everyone, including the public. So thank you for recognizing that spaying and neutering is important and allowing me to come tonight. Thank you.
Okay, you're very welcome. Okay, moving on, we have a very special presentation now, and this is 6B in the introduction and oath of office for police officers Salen Elming and Tyler Kinney. And I'm going to turn this over to our police chief, Chief Annibale, if you'd come forward and grab the portable mic, and it's all yours.
Okay. I think I'll start
by breaking our microphone. That's good.
Bad start. Good evening, Mayor and Council and guests here tonight. I'm very pleased, as always, to introduce two new police officers to the Arroyo Grande Police Department. And so I would like to call Tyler Kinney and Salen Elming up so I can start the process here. I'd like to say a little bit about both these officers, and then we will, from there, go into the swearing-in ceremony and, of course, the badge pinning. So with that, let me first, before I introduce them in more detail, tell everyone, and I'm going to slip around here a little bit, tell everyone a little bit about our hiring process. I think it's important to know. Arroyo Grande Police Department, like many departments, has a pretty aggressive hiring process. But most of all, in Arroyo Grande, we really feel that we pick the cream of the crop. We extend our process out and includes not only the traditional interviews and things you would expect in a job process, but these candidates are put through many other things that I'm sure they recall from presentations they have to do, and of course what we call situation simulations or role playing, where they actually, as part of the process, have to role play the role of an officer in very difficult situations. They're scored on all those areas, both the role play, presentations, interviews, and of course their background and experience, education, and others. So when you come out on top in Arroyo Grande, you've done very well, and so we're very pleased to have them here tonight. So first I'd like to introduce Tyler Kinney. He's a seasoned police officer joining us from the Bakersfield Police Department as a lateral. He's been at Bakersfield for 8 years with 8 years experience. He attended Bakersfield's Law Enforcement Academy, and while in the academy, he was awarded the Defensive Tactics Award. Also, during the time he was in Bakersfield, he was assigned to patrol, school resource officer, and has experience working with the gang unit, bike patrol, and downtown footbeat enforcement. While an SRO, the school resource officer, he received training and taught the GREAT, which is stands for Gang Resistance Education and Training Program, to sixth graders, and also instructed at the Junior Police Academy. He's also helped test and train his department with COPLINK, which is a crime and suspect research program, and he's also attended Bakersfield and Taft College. Tyler and his family are moving to the Central Coast, and my understanding is you visited here much before. So we're real excited to have him, and in a moment we'll swear him in. Next, I'd like to introduce Salen Elming. He's a new resident to Oro Grande. He was born and raised in Shaver Lake, California, a small community in the Sierra Nevada mountains. So, Salen, that's the ocean over that way, just so you know. Salen has worked with his family and their two customer service businesses since he was 13 years old. Working alongside his family has given him solid values and instilled a great work ethic and taught him respect for others. In 2012, Salen graduated from Fresno State University with a bachelor's degree in criminology. He attended the College of the Sequoias Police Academy in Hanford and graduated in 2013. Salen was sworn into the Fresno County Sheriff's Office, working for 2 years on the Boating Enforcement Unit, which must be a good job. In addition, he has logged numerous hours on patrol and worked on the transportation unit, transporting inmates throughout California. With his time in the Sheriff's Office has been a great training ground for Salen, and he's now looking forward to furthering his career here with the Oro Grande Police Department and exploring and becoming part of the community here in Oro Grande. And we're very pleased to have both these gentlemen here with us tonight. So at this time, I'd like to have the clerk come up to do the oath of office, and then I have a few other things that I would like to give the new officers. My job's to hold the mic. Is both his wallet, badge, and ID, and a couple other trinkets. But most important, that little white envelope that's sticking out there is a letter from me to them with their expectations we have for them in the department. So in Oro Grande, we spell out right when you get started here what the expectations are. And so I make sure that in front of everyone, I give them his expectations. So there's that. And now I'm sure you have someone you'd like to put your badge on. Your wife? Okay, let me take that from you so you don't have to hold that. Because this badge pinning can be a dangerous business. There you go. Great. Congratulations. Switch. Same drill for you. We seem to do, in police, we do the same thing over and over. Again, ID, wallet, badge, expectations that are very important, so I suggest you read them. I'll take those now. And do you have someone you'd like? Oh, Mom's always good. There you go, Mom. Congratulations. If you'd like to shake hands with council, please feel free. And staff, of course.
Congratulations. Welcome. Welcome. Glad you went.
Thank you very much.
Okay, you're all welcome to stay for the rest of the agenda if you like. We'll be out of here in about 2 or 3 hours, so that always does a trick. Okay, very good. We're going to move on the agenda. And next is item 7, community comments and suggestions. This is an opportunity for members of the public to come forward and comment on any item that is not on this evening's agenda. The Brown Act restricts the council from taking any action on matters not published on the agenda. We would ask that you keep your comments brief, 3 minutes or less. Anyone who would like to come forward, once again, items not on this evening's agenda, this would be your opportunity. Anyone? Okay, seeing no one, we're going to close community comments and suggestions, and we will move to the consent agenda. And we are on agenda item 8, and the consent agenda is normally a group of items that the council approves in one motion. Unless there is an item on the consent agenda that a member of the council would like to pull for further clarification, a question, or an independent action. This is also an opportunity for members of the public to come forward on any of the items on consent. And if you're following along, we're going to be addressing consent items 8A through 8D, David. So if there is anyone in the audience who would like to come forward on any of those consent items, this would be your chance to do so. Anyone? Okay, seeing no one, we're going to close public comment on the consent agenda. I'll bring this back to the council. What is the will of the council this evening? Anything to pull?
No.
Okay, we have no items to pull. I'll entertain a motion to approve the consent items.
So moved. Second.
All right, we have a motion to approve consent items 8A through 8D and a second. Tim, anything to read in there this evening?
No, Mayor Farrar.
Okay, thank you very much. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Barnidge?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Farrar?
Yes. And that takes us to item 9, public hearings. We have two this evening. 9A is consideration of our community development block grant CDBG projects for 2014. Kelly, good evening.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. The community development block grant program provides federal funding to local governments to address a wide range of community development needs, such as affordable housing, social services, and job creation. The allocation of funds is flexible, provided that activities meet one of three national. The city only received two applications, totaling $25,000. As guidance for recommending which public service projects to fund, the city has these particular criteria, which are on the screen. So these include providing basic needs for people, serve people of Rio Grande, demonstrate the need for services within the city, receive most of the program funding from local sources and donations, provide requests that are proportional and fair, would encounter a budget crisis if funds were withheld or drastically cut, provide services at the county level where no local facilities exist, and then demonstrate the timely and efficient use of previous CDBG funds. So based on these criteria, staff recommends that the CAPSLO Adult Wellness and Prevention Screening Program be funded with the maximum amount the city can provide, which is the $8,657. Of the two proposed public service applications that are submitted, staff believes that this program best satisfies the screening criteria. The funding request is also close to the estimated amount that we can provide. And then other projects fall under public facilities, economic development, elimination of slums and blight, and administration. Council considered preliminary recommendations last December and directed staff to transfer $10,000 from the facade grant allocation to city ADA projects, which is reflected in the table on the screen. Staff therefore recommends allocating $35,401 for ADA improvements, $5,000 for facade improvements, and then $8,657 for administration. We'd like to note that that amount for administration is about 15% instead of the 20% that we are actually allowed. It was also recommended that council consider using local sales tax funds to help finance public service requests in lieu of CDBG funds, excuse me. And that was during the December meeting. This would allow the city more flexibility in granting funds compared to the strict federal requirements attached to CDBG funding. The intent was to use CDBG funds for ADA improvements and then utilize local sales tax funds for public service requests. Council supported the concept of increasing flexibility of awarding public service grants, but expressed concern over using local sales tax funds for any purpose other than the original intent for the local sales tax ballot measure. So staff has developed recommendations for next year's funding designed to address council's objectives and recommends that council direct staff to implement several changes in the CDBG process, which include eliminate all CDBG funding for public services, increase $10,000 in local sales tax funding for the Five Cities Fire Authority, reduce general fund funding for the Five Cities Fire Authority by $10,000, reduce local sales tax funding for ADA ramps by $10,000, increase CDBG funding for ADA projects by $10,000, appropriate $10,000 in the general fund for public service grants, and establish a program for accepting applications for public service grants. The recommended community service grant program, which we would be establishing for awarding public service grants, includes the following criteria and measures. Grants awarded will be a minimum of $250. An organization must satisfy certain standards to be eligible, which include serve the greater Aurora Grande community, operate as a nonprofit organization, and directly provide a social service, educational, or cultural program. Funds cannot be used for religious activities. And following the deadline for submittal of applications, a community service grant committee will make recommendations to the City Council. The committee is recommended to consist of one appointee per council member. So to conclude, staff recommends that council adopt a resolution to approve the proposed funding for projects as presented and approve recommendations to change the funding and process for public services for 2015. And always we have alternatives. Council could modify the resolution to include other public service requests, eliminate funding for public service requests to increase funding for ADA projects, increase funding for facade improvements and proportionally reduce funding for ADA improvements, or provide other direction to staff. So with that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Questions for Kelly?
Yes.
Okay, Councilmember Brown.
So we're getting basically two ADA ramps for 10 grand. Is there some way in the future that we might spread that money around, because there's plenty of, in this economic time, there's plenty of good organizations that need that funding or need that money, or there might be other things we could do. So not that I'm against the proposal, I would like council to think about if we're really getting a bang for our buck. And I think Mayor Pro Tem's discussion about the cost per ADA ramp is really a compelling one, and I don't think we're adding that much to the equation by putting 10 grand into that area. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but it just seems like if we're doing two ramps and we could be possibly doing a lot more good for some other agencies or organizations that need it, I'd like to at least float that idea and have people, you know, talk about that. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Okay. Do you want to respond to that, Steve?
Just to remind that staff's original proposal was to try to take all the money to the ADA ramps and not fund the public services. And so this was kind of a compromise where we maintained and even increased a little bit the money for the social services and put it into another program that will make it more flexible so there are other organizations that can use it. The ADA money, keep in mind, we're not going to just do two ramps. What we're trying to do is pull from a lot of different sources so we can get, I think we were targeting more in the area, somewhere between $50,000 and $70,000 for ramps so we can really make progress. But the main point I wanted to make is just emphasize it's just striking a balance, and don't disagree with anything you're saying. It's just where is that balance? So, but that was our intent in coming up with this recommendation.
Okay. Mayor Pro Tem? Did you have a question?
I don't have a question.
Okay. No. Yes, so just clarification from
Councilman Brown, we actually suggested moving the $10,000 from facade improvement directly into the to fund the groups, because I think what's missing is, remember, we're limited in how much we can. We're limited to the $8,600, so we couldn't move the facade improvements directly to help the groups in the CDBG funding.
Okay, good point. I appreciate the clarification.
My question and kind of comment is where do we come up with $250? I kind of think we might be going too far the other way here. You know, $10,000 by 250 is a lot of organizations. I'm wondering where we come up with the idea of 250 instead of maybe 1,000, so that I can see this group here meeting for weeks and weeks and weeks with 50 applications otherwise.
Two things. One, we modeled this off of a program that another city has done fairly successfully. Secondly, keep in mind the rules will be changing here because of that flexibility, whereas the CDBG funds are pretty restricted to just certain types of social service providers. Normally, the way these programs work and the way we envision them is this would open up to a lot of other community-based organizations that do all kinds of things. So you might have organizations like Aurora Grandy and Bloom or the Village Improvement Association or different groups that are just looking for small, you know, they're doing small projects and are actually looking for just smaller amounts of money, and this gives you the flexibility to include a lot more folks in that. But this was intended just to be a starting point, so certainly we're looking for your direction and open to changes.
I guess my feeling is that we are. I understand what you're saying, but when we get down to this small a grant, that I think that the part of me says start big and reduce it down from there. But I and maybe we split the difference. I just feel like the $250 is going to be a whole lot of little tiny grants that we're going to see, rather than see. One of the things that drove the difficulty with CDBG funding was that the federal government wanted you to actually show that you had an impact. You know, not just you distributed the money, that you showed that you have an impact. And while we're not going to ask for that, I think we still want to be sure that when we're funding something, that we're funding something that really is going to have an impact in our community. And I just feel like the $250 is. And maybe I've been involved with this too much, and I'm overthinking it, but I do think that $250 might make it so small that we're just going to fund a bunch of little things. And people who, if you remember back 5 or 6 years ago, we had a lot of organizations that we funded that were never able to put together their deal. You know, we're never able to come back and get the funding, and ultimately we had to spend it all on ADA stuff anyway. So that's my concern, is that we'll be funding a lot of things that either don't get done or don't have an impact. So that's my comment.
I think that's a very legitimate argument. Frankly, I think we may have misunderstood kind of the direction you were wanting to take. I think we thought doing this change and pulling it out of the CDBG, I thought...
Into a civilian committee? Who's the staff person? What kind of support are we going to have here?
We haven't identified whose responsibility that'll be yet. There'll definitely be staff assigned. We'd want to keep as much of the actual work on the committee itself, but we would be vetting each application and making sure we get background information on each organization that we felt that the committee would need to make the decision. Some of that would have to be evolutionary as we get into this and find out kind of what the committee's concerns are and what they'd like to see and what the application looks like. So a lot of that we haven't worked out yet, but certainly that would be the intent of the direction we'd be taking.
The other, I guess the reason why I asked that question is, have we developed criteria at all for selection of the a particular application? And I guess the reason why I ask that is because, getting at what the Mayor Pro Tem was mentioning a second ago, there could be other factors. An organization making an application could be asking for the city to match other funds that they have, could be augmented by volunteers, could be a small amount, but the mark that they're going to leave is pretty big because they're doing it all with volunteer labor. So there are other factors to consider. And I'm wondering if that's going to be distilled somehow in criteria and made available to the committee? I mean, is there a screening process at all, or do we know yet?
I think we'd be developing that criteria and then bringing that back to you for review and approval before we move forward with. At the time we formed the committee, I think we'd bring that criteria to you and get your feedback on that and formalize that.
And the last thing that I wanted to ask is, there been discussion about the fact that this may well be an ad hoc committee? And the reason why I mention that is because depending on how we're doing economically, budget-wise, this committee may at some point go away, or at least be stayed until we're back on our feet. If we've given any consideration to that at all.
In terms of
not spending the money.
I'm sorry, I'm confused on the question. How the committee is going to be structured?
Okay, let's say, for example, the shifting of the money that we're going to do. There's an economic downturn like we're just coming out of. We can't afford to practice that any longer. So do we suspend the community grant program at that point?
The way I saw it is this program would have to be approved each year, so it wouldn't be automatically carry over to the next year. When we come forward with the probably consistent with this process, we would come forward.
Or it could be reflected in a line item in the budget.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. This is a public hearing, and at this time we'd like to invite members of the public to come forward. Anyone who would like to speak to 9A, this would be your opportunity. Anyone? Come forward, please.
Good evening, Mayor and Council members. My name is Grace McIntosh. I'm the Deputy Director at Community Action Partnership. And on behalf of our staff and our participants in our Adult Wellness and Screening Program, I want to so thank you for your consideration of the recommendation by staff. And I want to really thank the staff. I know that the last couple of years especially has been very challenging to make decisions of all of the very worthy requests that I'm sure have been put before you. So, this community is well served by our program, and in fact, proportionately, we serve a larger number of your residents than any other city or municipality in the county. So, we're at 3 regular sites all throughout the year, and what's really interesting is even with ACA, we're seeing a lot of people that are not able to access services, that are frustrated. We do surveys all the time. Our most recent survey, actually, almost 52% of the participants reported that our clinics were the only source of preventive or maintenance health services, and in some cases were their only source of health services at all. So I really want to thank you for supporting our ever-growing number of seniors. Just really thank you for your support and urge you to pass the recommendation. Any questions?
Okay. Thank you for your comments.
Thank you.
Anyone else who would like to come forward? Okay, last chance. Seeing no one, we'll close the public hearing portion of
allocating what I consider a pretty small amount of money. And so I'd like to see it raised, too, as the Mayor Pro Tem talked about, for future grant awards. And other than that, I have no other problem with the current recommendation.
Okay. Thank you, Councilmember Barnage.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I would agree with Councilmember Costello and Councilmember Brown, but I probably would like the minimum grant. I was thinking 500, but really probably 1,000 is something that someone can really do something with. So 500 or 1,000 is, but I'll go with the majority of the council on that. Thank you.
And Mayor Pro Tem.
Well, yeah, and first of all, I'll comment on the mayor's comment. I think that this is really more dependent on whether the CBDG funding continues. This was meant to be a replacement for the CBDG program. Even at the very worst that we experienced in 2008-2007, we did, in fact, allocate all the CDBG funding that was available for four organizations. So I think in the future, if CDBG funding went away, we might consider the program going away. But it's not really I mean, if we had an even worse situation than we were in 4 or 5 years ago, then yeah, of course, everything's off on the table. But I really think this is much more tied to the CDBG program, and hopefully we could continue it even if CDBG went away. So I can support the recommendations of staff as to the funding with the CDBG funding. And going forward, I do think I was getting ready to split the difference at $500, and I think that that's probably a place to start. And then we'll take a look at the first year of the process and see if it becomes cumbersome, which I actually think that it might. And then we could have that recommendation, or the committee could just sort of impose its own direction on that if that's the way they see it going. But so I would say let's just make it $500 just to, and if it turns out that that's too high and we really want to split it up even farther than that, then we can always come back and revisit it. But I do think 250 is just going to invite a lot of little requests that I'm really more concerned will never come to fruition than the ones that would be multiplied by volunteers and other money. So that's my input.
Okay. Well, I'm relatively comfortable with the positions that others have stated, but just wanted to add, it's ironic because we are in the process right now of looking at some grants from foundations in the whole public art arena. And it's interesting because the latest one that we looked at happened to be pretty local. Had a number of categories for people who wanted to apply for money, and it was purely amount driven. They had a category from I think 1,000 to 5,000, 5,000 to 10,000, 10,000 to 15, and so on and so forth. But they also had a category for amounts under 1,000, and that application process was like about a half a page. But when you got into the larger amounts, then you had to have a complete project description, pictures, benefit to the community, and all of the rest of this stuff. So it got more complex the higher the amount was that you were applying for. So I'm comfortable actually with at least allowing for a smaller amount to be identified by the organization, and the reason why is because some organizations can take a small amount of money and make a big difference. And so there are other factors that they can bring to bear. There's other money that they can bring to bear. So they may be asking the city for a smaller amount, but yet what they choose to do might make a significant difference based on all of those other variables. So I would like to see maybe a general category, and maybe we approach this with varying processes as relates to applications. Somebody wants to, and maybe we have a general application for all amounts under 1,000, and we don't ask for so much on that. So, I can go either way, but I just think we ought to leave the amount unspecified. I can't imagine somebody coming in and asking for less than 250. In fact, they may not ask for too much less than 500, but having just the general category of $1,000 or less, I don't think that hurts anything. The nice thing about this program is that we control it, and so if we implement it and we find out that it's either task intensive for staff or we're not getting any action in a certain category, then we can work things around to where it's operating smoothly. Sometimes we don't know until we get into it. So, again, at some point.
We're definitely going to come back with more specific criteria.
Okay.
As far as the levels, that I think we're hoping to get some direction on that, since there was a lot of different opinions. Okay,
well, in that case, again, I don't know if we need an actual motion, but I would move to the mayor's suggestion that we have it on a sliding scale from 1,000 under and allow you to see what works and doesn't work. He was pretty convincing in his argument. That's why I tried to get him to craft a motion. But is that what you're looking for?
Can we just add approve staff's recommendations with the language regarding 1,000 or under, and,
yes,
and we're there?
Yes. That's my motion.
Just, all right. Just let's go back to the motion maker. Would you... Is it too late for a friendly amendment, or do we have to do a...
We're taking them separately. The resolution's done. We're just going to deal specifically now with staff's recommendations on the program.
All right. Then we have a motion and a second.
Do we have a
discussion on that?
All right. Just to clarify, so can nobody apply for over $1,000?
No, you said other categories above as well. That's why I'm thinking this ought to go back maybe to staff and have you work up maybe a more finite concept of how this could go.
Okay. We'd be glad to take that input back and try to come up with something that makes sense. The only thing I was going to add is to think about how many grants do you think you'd want to issue? Because if you have it at 1,000, that means you're doing 10 grants. Mm-hmm. If you're comfortable with that, then that's good. But if we go under, then there's a lot more flexibility. So we'll come up with some we'll come up with some options. Why don't we put that way?
The language was 1,000 or under. Isn't that what?
I'm glad to amend it if it makes council feel better. Whatever direction.
So what is the motion?
Yeah.
I'm totally confused now.
So on page 6, is that what?
Right. All the staff recommendations are on the top of page 6, and what we'd be doing is changing the first one. Grants awarded will be in the minimum amount of not less than 250. Mm-hmm. And now what I'm hearing is, and just let's clarify this, do we want absolute flexibility, or is $1,000 a cap? Is that the maximum?
I think they wanted to ask staff to come back with
$1,000 is not a cap. It's not a cap.
No.
Okay. Did you want to keep 250 as the minimum, or did you want to lift it higher? Because that's really the only issue that's left now, and then we'll flesh this thing out and bring it back for a little more concrete action. But on that issue, we could probably use the direction.
Well, let me ask, instead of the motion, can we do this with staff direction? Is it okay if you withdraw the motion then?
I am withdrawing my motion as we speak.
All right, then we'll just do it with staff direction. I'd like you guys to take a shot at it and see if we can tighten this up, based on what you've heard tonight.
I think we can do that.
All right.
And I'll add my 10 cents worth if I can, and that's actually, I think we should go the other direction, and we're going to end up with way too many grad applications if we open it wide open like that. But let's see what you guys come up with.
I'll try to come up with a balance.
Okay. How's everybody doing?
Good.
All right.
It's not even 7 yet.
Then we're going to move to 9B, our second public hearing. This is consideration of an ordinance repealing chapters 13.24 of the Aurora Grande Municipal Code and adopting a new chapter 13.24 entitled Governing, Grading, adding a new Chapter 25 to Title 13, regulating illegal discharges and illicit connections, and adding new sections to Title 16, Chapters 8 and 68, regarding redesign requirements for post-construction stormwater compliance. Everybody get all of that? Good evening, Mike.
Oh, good evening. As an introduction, I'll just blatantly read from the staff report, which was eloquently prepared by Director McClish. The city is required to adopt regulations in order to comply with the requirements of the Federal Clean Water Act. The implementing regulations for the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, NPDES, and the California Porter Cologne Water Quality Control Act. These requirements provide for the regulation and reduction of pollutants discharged to waters of the state and United States by extending these requirements to stormwater and urban runoff discharges to and from municipal storm drain systems. So the city implements these requirements through the stormwater management program that was originally approved by the City Council in 2003. The program requires regulations to manage stormwater discharges within the city and is by March 6th, which is just a little more than a month away. So tonight we're actually requesting three separate documents. One is Title 16, Chapter 68, which is amending our development code to allow for the post-construction guidance. And we're also taking it as an opportunity to upgrade our grading ordinance, which is Title 13, Chapter 24, which regulates all grading, any kind of earthwork activity within the city, to make sure that it complies and augments the post-construction guidance. And then we're also adding Title 13, Chapter 25, a new section for illicit discharge, which is similar to what we have for sewer discharge or illegal connections, to make sure that somebody's not trying to circumvent the system and just connect directly into the creek or our waterways. So as you can see, we're counting down from the March 6, 2014 date of when we're mandated. So we have two council readings, February 11th tonight, and then in 2 weeks on February 25th. We previously went through the Planning Commission on February 4th, just a week ago, and counting back further than that, we took an opportunity to meet with developers, contractors, engineers, anybody in the area. We just blanketed 500 different mailings to different places, trying to get people to come in and work with the city to show them what we are required to do, and requesting their input. And so on January 23rd, we held a public workshop right here in this facility, and we had about 15 people that actually attended. And out of the 15, we had a pretty broad representation, pretty equal in terms of developers, contractors. We had a few architects, and they had some very good comments. One thing we had to emphasize to them, that this is pretty much nationwide, and what you happen to do within the city of Arroyo Grande, since it is an MS4 permit for all these cities, you're pretty much going to have to comply with any city of a similar size within the city, state of California. And similarly, if you go to Iowa, Florida, anywhere, you're going to have some form of these same regulations. So we have a certain amount of wiggle room within the regulations, but it's pretty much mandated to what these requirements are. We can't waive them. All we can do is administer them and enforce them. And I'll explain that a little bit later as we go on. So the primary objective we're trying to do with the post-construction requirements is to ensure the reduction of pollutant discharges to the maximum extent practicable, which is the new buzzword, that's as best we can, and to prevent any kind of stormwater discharges from causing or contributing to a violation of receiving water quality standards and all applicable development projects. And one thing that we're really trying to emphasize, they're trying to get, instead of just taking the stormwater that you would traditionally, in the past, you would just take from the site and take into the stormwater system and go into a waterway, they're trying to get as much as possible to actually stay on the property. So they're trying to get the previous development infiltration to equal what the post-development is, regardless of what was put in terms of impervious surfaces. That's what we say here, trying to mimic the stormwater flow on the undeveloped, undisturbed property with the post-development. And there's three main considerations that they're concerned with, and this just depends upon the square footage of the property that these kick in. But the first is site design, where you're actually placing the structures or the impervious surfaces on the property to try to maximize the infiltration and flow of the water. The water quantity, and the quality of the water that it's treated before it goes into the aquifer or into any stormwater facility. This is a little out of sequence. I'll take this later, but this is LID. What does LID stand for? Low impact development measures. That's right. These are some certain things you can do on the property. One is to collect it in rain barrels or a rain garden, where you can see they have pervious surfaces that allow water to collect and flow into the landscaping elements, which would then filter the water before it goes further. These are a couple other ones. The one on the left, the ribbon driveway, is known as a Hollywood-style driveway, where you have some kind of landscaping, which again allows it to filter into the system. Same with the pervious pavers. It actually allows the water, instead of sheeting off the side, to actually go in and infiltrate into the driveway itself. So private development projects, discretionary projects, projects that have not received first discretionary approval of project design prior to March 6, 2014. And I don't believe that we have any of those on the books at the moment. Different watershed management zones. And this is dependent upon the topography, whether it's a hillside, a valley, whether you have readily percolable soils that allow the water to infiltrate, or whether it just sheets right off, whether there's sensitive waterway areas or slopes, hillsides that could be subject to seismic activity. Well, out of the eight, we actually have the easiest two, number one and two, the easiest to comply with. Zone one, infiltration, which you can see in the dark, purple to some people, to me it's dark blue. It's mostly sand. That's what we have south of Highway 1. And that allows ready infiltration of the systems. That's where we have at the Soto complex, we have the retention basins. When you get to the light blue areas within the city, that's more of a denser soil, a clay, which does not allow ready infiltration. But as you can see, Zone 1 allows for infiltration, fairly easy to comply with. Zone 2, they still want you to infiltrate as much as possible, and what you can't, then you take a stormwater best management practice, such as some kind of facility like the rain gardens or whatever, that will collect it, that will offset what you can't do with the infiltration. So these are the performance requirement categories. Less than 2,500 square feet, which isn't a whole lot, no requirements, at least for the moment. Between 2,500 and 5,000 square feet, which is mostly residential, there are certain site design measures that you're going to have to do to make it comply, depending on the watershed management zone that you're in, of course. Between 5 and 15,000, then they want some kind of water quality treatment, and we can go into that a little bit later. 15,000 to 22,500, they want on-site retention, and then more than 25,000 square feet, which would be more of your development, they want peak management. There's specific criteria that they want to see in place with the peak management. So here's more than 2,500 square feet. That's the first level. And each of these levels, of course, the requirements just attach to the next level. It's a hierarchy that gets progressively more regulations. So 2,500 square feet of impervious surface. So if you had a typical home that they were going to add on to, the impervious surface obviously would be the house itself and, let's say, the driveway. If you're going to add 2,500 square feet to that, not including what was already built, adding 2,500 square feet of impervious surface, that is when everything starts to kick in that is listed here. They want to prevent any kind of disturbance to the creek. That's obvious. They want to minimize the compaction of the native soils. They don't want something that's going to exacerbate the infiltration that is already present. They want to limit the clearing and grading of native vegetation. And a lot of this has to do with how you're going to site these impervious elements on the property. They want to minimize the amount of impervious surfaces, obviously, like the Hollywood driveway, where you're not doing one wide driveway, but actually doing a combination. And if you have to, direct any kind of runoff to some kind of structural best management practice that can deal and filter the stormwater. Now we go more than 2,500. This is the next level. Okay, this is the same level. Within the square foot calculations, this is what the plan they have to submit to us for us to review. We want to see what they're removing, adding, or replacing in terms of any kind of paved surface, the buildings and structures that are on the property, any kind of upgrades, and as stated here, the projects that are not included in this is just any kind of surface repair, a secondary addition onto a house, because you're not adding any collection that you wouldn't have otherwise, and trails or bike paths, assuming that they're readily allow ready infiltration. Now we go over to 5,000 square feet of additional area, to 15,000 square feet. This is where the low-impact development systems fall into place. designed to retain the 85th percentile 24-hour storm event. And actually, that's actually a 20-year storm event. But they have the most of it collected over 20 years. So 85% of the water that previously would run off, now you have to make sure it either infiltrates or is treated in somehow before it goes out. And an engineer has to actually prove to us that it calculates to meet that. Biofiltration systems is much like a bioswale that allows the water to go through in one area and slowly percolate through some kind of vegetation which allows filtering of any kind of impurities. Non-retention of how they're going to comply with those requirements. So here's just a listing of what's normally required in a stormwater control plan. Obviously, project name, application number, which they have to receive from the state, the total project site area, and the most critical factor is what new impervious area relative to the impervious area they had before. The big buzzword, too, is net impervious area, because you may be taking out a driveway, which would then remove part of the impervious area that's there, but you're adding more, so it's what was there before versus what's there now, net impervious area. Of course, all the documentation and calculation, and if you can't meet these particular requirements, a documentation of why you can't meet the compliance, and there's some alternate compliance procedures that they can go through in order to meet the requirements of this of these new requirements. Now, over 22,500 peak management requirements. So now they have to actually have water quality treatment and runoff retention performance in addition to what they had before. So the post-development peak flow shall not exceed the pre-project peak flows for the 2 through 10 year storm event. Now, an important part of this, and this was something that a lot of cities were very concerned with, is we have limited staff time. And with a lot of these requirements, you have to make sure that after the developer or the homeowner puts in these measures, that they're going to operate in the future like they were the day they were installed. So we have to have a way of developing, recording, and implementing an operation and maintenance plan. So the engineer has to actually make up a plan of how you go about dealing with these things and the frequency of how it's going to be inspected. Now, how it's going to be inspected is very important. And documenting that it was inspected and whether it has to be a means of which they give that information to the city so that we can track it. And as it says here, the city responsibility, you must track the private and project, private and public projects and keep detailed records. So all through the city, anywhere where these have ever been installed, we're going to make sure that they're still operating the way they were, they've been inspected, and the onus is on us to comply. And with that, we submit an annual report to the Water Board. And I know in the past on construction projects, whenever I had a problem with a contractor, I could just threaten to call OSHA, and that would make them comply immediately, and OSHA would come out, and if they're out on the site, it can create a lot of problems. Terms of investigations. This is a different animal. We can't just call the State Water Resource Control Board and tell them of a violation because that's our responsibility. In a way, we're deputized by them to administer the program to the requirements that they've laid out. And that pretty much completes my staff report. I know Jeff English is here. There were a few things that were brought up by the developers. A few of the questions, I could probably go through those real quick. One thing they were wondering about, alternative compliance, what you have to do, or at what point does it trigger that you have to go into alternative compliance? And the answer we got from the state, we passed this right on to them. The depth of an impervious layer, such as bedrock, how much it will limit infiltration. And with this, obviously, they'd have to do some kind of percolation test where they test the original capacity of the soil versus what it would be after development. Any kind of space constraints. So, for instance, if we were to redevelop this property, you already have, you hardly have any impervious area left. stormwater control measures within 100 foot of a groundwater well, and incompatibility with surrounding drainage systems. There's a whole list of things that they require, but there is a procedure that we have within the documents that you have that show how the alternative compliance must be dealt with. They had concerns about our engineering plan. We had a limit of 50 cubic yards that you'd have to actually have an engineer grading plan. We checked into it. They were correct. We made the corrections to the chapter 13.24 for the grading ordinance to accommodate that. And they'd asked about possibly banking, that if you had two or three different sites, that possibly you could use them as a whole, that you put all the requirements on one site and not put it on the other and balance them out. And what we've got from the state is that pretty much every site has to stand alone on its own, that you have to prove that that particular site cannot meet the requirements and kicks into the alternative compliance. It would be added to her duties, and maybe Teresa.
And what about enforcement time?
Enforcement, in a way, we're relying on an honesty policy. We will have to go out and spot check a few of them, especially based on past experience with certain developers or contractors. But for the most part, we have to take the documentation that they give us and rely upon it as being reliable.
So there's not going to be a lot of actual oversight once this federal program is implemented.
I could answer that better in another year.
Okay, so, Steve, maybe you can answer this question, and I'll leave it at that. Is this basically an unfunded mandate? In other words, it's going to take staff time and staff energy, and yet it's another thing we've been put upon by some other level of government.
Well, let me jump in here for a second. there's the short answer to your question is yes. And this has been a hot topic with the League of California Cities, specifically the Environmental Quality Policy Committee has been, there's a tremendous amount of pushback from cities right now. Cities and the League are taking the whole stormwater management plan as it has been force-fed to us by Regional Water Quality Control and EPA, Cal EPA, for that very reason. It is staff intensive. It is cost intensive. Those costs are borne not just by the municipality but by the developers as well. It's a draconian system that they have put in place. So far they've not demonstrated any flexibility. We are trying, when I say we're trying, the League and a number of cities are trying to look for a legislator that will carry some additional legislation to ease some of this stuff. So to date, I haven't heard of any that that have stepped forward, but this is a new legislative session forthcoming, and I suspect there's going to be some attempts to try and ease this thing because it's causing pain to a lot of cities.
Okay, so, and maybe you can follow up, Mr. Mayor, or someone, is the idea, and I could be completely off base, but is the idea that having a charter city might get us away from unfunded mandates?
Some unfunded mandates. This is not one of them, though, I don't think. We're stuck with this.
Because it's a federal.
Well, it's coming down from the feds, but the state are enforcing it rigorously.
Okay.
Did you have a
quick question?
Sorry, were you done?
No, I'm done. Thank you.
Okay. A quick question, and you might be able to answer this, Tony, I know it's staff. Let's say something, a developer doesn't do what he needs to do. I mean, we got the paperwork that said they would. There's a problem that comes up a year from now, 2 years from now. Is the city going to be held responsible? Is the city going to have to pay fines, penalties, or what happens?
Mike? No, we're not. There's no city liability for that specific issue.
Thank you.
Did you have a question?
Yes, please. It was just, I think you already went over it, Mike, but I might have missed part of it. So when the property owner submits the yearly report to the city, you're going to look over it and then put it into a database. But for an example of like the retention basins getting filled in, or something not being maintained how it's supposed to be maintained, so you'll just spot check those, but you won't check all of them. It just depends.
I think it'd be a little of both, but actually, I probably left out of the presentation that the requirement is actually recorded against the property for perpetuity.
Right.
So it lists within the operation and maintenance plan all the retention basins,
okay,
all of the little components. So if somebody fills it in, when they have their engineer or whoever is doing it per their plan,
mm-hmm,
is not conforming,
mm-hmm,
they have to demonstrate why that was performed and what they're doing to counteract it. But yes, we will have to spot check to make sure that's done. And we'll actually have to take the plan and laboriously go through and make sure that everything is consistent and in compliance with that operation and maintenance plan that was submitted.
Okay, okay. And then you went over it a little bit, I think, but my question on the workshop that you held on the 23rd, what were the contractors and the architects' suggestions? I mean, you brought up one, but were there any other suggestions we could incorporate or not?
Well, the things they brought up was like the banking.
Right, okay.
We took their comments and we passed it to the state board.
Okay.
We didn't try to put our own subjective opinion on it. We got their opinion.
Okay, and so everything they asked about
affect their projects economically. I've just turtled that a little bit with conversations thus far.
Okay, thank you for that.
Just to get some perspective, what is a 24-hour 10-year event? Is it 6 inches of rain, 8 inches of rain?
I'd have to get back to you on that one. I wouldn't know right off the top of my head.
Any perspective at all on what it is?
Yeah, I haven't poured through the rain data myself. No pun intended.
So is it different community by community and year by year? Is it going to change over time?
It's based on actual rainfall data for this city.
And then, so how does this affect like a subdivision that's already been approved that has a shared let's use Cherry Creek as an example. So Cherry Creek has a drainage plan in place, but the house hasn't been built yet. Do they get to stay with their already approved plan, or are they going to have to meet this new requirement?
So that particular development was already subjected to most of these types of requirements that were incorporated generally in the site design. However, every lot that's constructed has to incorporate its own requirements for that particular lot. We have heard very frustration from the developers on that property because even though the whole tract included stormwater controls tract-wide and were required to prepare a lengthy document, stormwater pollution prevention plan, that they submit to the state and that's tracked, when they sell off a lot, that does not go with the lot. And so now we have a lot owner that has very rigorous controls for that lot that has to prepare a big extensive document in order to comply with state water requirements. We did try to work with the water board to require what would typically be required for a single family lot in the city that was apart from a larger subdivision. But in this particular case, if it's a lot within a common subdivision, they look at that as cumulative effects as part of that subdivision. They look at it just like it was a development larger than an acre, and it triggers the more onerous requirements. So this is a good example of kind of the stringent requirements that we're dealing with and that developers are dealing with in our community.
And I think that pretty much answers what was going to be my next question, is looking at where we have already in place, like at Cortland and Ground, we have this shared retention basin, which clearly would retain the 10-year storm anyway, as I think it would, for all those neighbors. Are they now not going to be able to use that retention basin because it's off-site? Because it's like banking?
Well, I think we have to be very careful in how we describe a project area when a project comes in.
Thank you.
It's just a curiosity issue. We talked about the climate action plan, and part of the idea about going behind that was that individual property owners wouldn't have to do certain CEQA issues because the plan was already approved by the city, so they wouldn't have to reinvent the wheel. I guess my question would be the same here. Is there some way we can adopt these federal guidelines so that the individual property owner is not having to reinvent the wheel? Because it just seems awfully onerous to have to do something that has pretty much already been done.
Well, let me follow up on that a little bit. This particular provision, a lot of the noise in this is interpretation by regulation from the state, is it not? I don't think what we're seeing is a carbon copy coming from the feds.
Certain requirements were pretty much given to us, and we're putting into our code. Very much so. There are some, you know, alternative compliance provisions. There's some places where we can, you know, take a closer look and see if there's site characteristics that we, that we can facilitate an appeal or an argument for alternative compliance to the board. But it's up to them at that point.
I think the rub here was, there's federal EPA stormwater requirements. But there was an ability for the states to interpret that and to decide how they wanted to apply it within a certain, broad boundary. Our state EPA should be a little more easy to swallow. Okay, anything else? All right.
One. Because I asked this in advance, but I'll just ask here. I mean, there's nothing in here that other communities of our size, in certainly in San Luis Obispo County or in the state, aren't adopting as well. I just had the same question on the climate control.
Right, we are all subject to the same requirements.
All right, so we would look at Grover Beach has probably already adopted this, or will be soon.
We have, and we are all adopting the same. They served it to us on a platter. Some communities are implementing it just because their codes are set up differently, but everybody's has the same requirements that we're proposing tonight.
I just want to be sure that was for the public.
What's the effect of not implementing it?
Well, I guess that goes back to this, the liability question a little bit. We have our, what we've called previously our stormwater management plan. Now we submit yearly a stormwater guidance document to the state. In that document, we're listing out all of our responsibilities for stormwater control and water quality protection. And each year we have to do certain things, and every year we add a few more things to do. Monitoring, inspections. How do we set up our system? We have to do all of that. If there's a site, a construction site, a development project that's not complying, then that enforcement comes directly from the water board.
So if it comes from the water board, why are we bound to have to approve something that actually should be enforced by someone else?
As Mike said, our responsibilities are to set the program up and administer the program, but they for private projects, enforcement, we're responsible for inspecting it, making sure that they know that what their requirements are, that things are installed. But if there's a violation, then that comes directly from the state. If we're violating by not completing our inspections or not doing what we're saying, then the city gets in trouble for that.
So there could be some level of city liability.
Well, specifically fines. I mean, that's the Water Quality Board operates off of fines, and we've experienced that already twice. and they're not lenient. They're pretty severe. And, yeah, so this, if we're not implementing our what we say or what we're required to do in terms of inspections, they will fine us. And if they go out and inspect properties under development within our community that aren't meeting requirements that we were supposed to regulate, they will fine us and the property owner in those cases.
Okay. Jeff, did you want to add anything? Okay, this is a public hearing. Anyone would like to come forward on this item? Okay, seeing none, we'll close the public hearing portion of 9B, bring this to the council. We'll start on my left with Councilmember Barnich.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Well, I'm ready to move forward because I think we have to move forward. I think that, the idea behind, if you go way back, the idea behind it is a good idea. I mean, I get what they're trying to do, but it just puts it all on the city with no way, for us to pay for the extra staff time, and then it is going to impact the developers and the architects. But I don't really see what we can change at this point. We'll just have to see how it goes. Thank you.
Okay. Councilmember Brown?
I'd like to ignore the whole thing, but seeing as I can't do that, I'll vote for it in the hopes that the League of Cities will actually have some pushback. I just find it amazing that, again, we have another example of we're being mandated to do, something that we have to provide the funding for in terms of staff time. And, again, everything looks good on paper, and it's just, but it creates pounds and pounds of paper for what good for the community. And so it's frustrating. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay. Councilmember Costello.
Well, I really can't add much to what my colleagues have already said. This is something we have to do, and I think we just need to implement it, comply with the regulations, and see whether or not we get some sort of legislative relief down the line on this. But I'll support this tonight.
Okay. Mayor Pro Tem.
I'll also support this, but I will echo part of Councilman Brown's comments earlier is to what extent could we facilitate? I mean, is it we have quite a few citywide soil studies already done, for instance. Is there some way that wouldn't, and we happen to have a particularly aggressive regional board that I think we're going to be dealing with for some time. But I don't see we have any choice but to move forward with this. Thank you.
We've already kind of discussed this to death. I think the thing that is distressing is that, in the heart of the recession, the policies and procedures of regulatory and enforcement agencies at the state level went into high gear. And the more you look at it in detail, the more discouraged you get, because the basic policy and procedure is that when a regulatory agency goes out, in this case, inspects a site, levies a fine, anyone who's connected with that particular incident, people that go out there, the people that review it, all of them attach themselves on paper to that fine. And the more fines generated, the more staff costs are offset. And that's the, kind of the very unattractive aspect and element of this whole process, but it's common among state enforcement and regulatory agencies these days. That's how they generate their operating costs. So they get very aggressive, and sometimes that aggression manifests itself in policies and procedures that we can't understand, and certainly it's difficult for us to manage them. So again, I'm hoping for some offsetting legislation that'll at least kind of neutralize some of this. I'm not hearing of any yet, but I hope it's forthcoming. So we'll move ahead with this. We have little option, as has been indicated. So I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Mayor, I move an ordinance to the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande repealing Chapter 13.24 of the Arroyo Grande Municipal Code, and adopting a new Chapter 13.24, governing grading, adding a new Chapter 25 to Title 13, regulating illegal discharges and illicit connections, and adding new sections to Title 16, Chapters 08 and 68 regarding design requirements for post-construction stormwater compliance.
Second.
All right, we have a motion and a second. Discussion? Hearing none. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Barnidge?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes.
We do have to take separate action on the first item. That's approving the design requirements for post-construction stormwater compliance. It's a separate standalone document, although it's
okay,
also...
Okay, if you look at staff's recommendation, number one there. Motion.
Mr. Mayor, move we approve the design requirements for post-construction stormwater compliance.
Second.
All right, we have a motion and a second. Discussion on this? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Barnidge?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. How's everybody doing?
Mm-hmm.
All right, then we're going to move on to item 11, new business. Consideration 11A is consideration of an ordinance adding section 8.44.060 to chapter 8.44 of Title 8 of the Rio Grande Municipal Code relating to weed abatement. And we have Chief Hubert with us. Good evening, Mike.
Good evening, Mike. Good evening, Honorable Mayor and Council members. What you have before you for consideration this evening is a proposed ordinance adding section 8.44.060 to Chapter 8.44 of Title 8 of the Arroyo Grande Municipal Code relating to weed abatement. As the Council knows, the City of Arroyo Grande, along with the City of Grover Beach and the Oceana Community Services District, created the Five Cities Fire Authority for the purpose of providing more efficient and effective fire protection services within each agency's respective jurisdiction. Since 2011, the authority has annually administered the weed abatement programs in accordance with the ordinances and procedures for each of the three agencies. However, each city and community services district has its own distinct process and timeframes for their abatement programs. We are recommending that the weed abatement process be standardized within the three communities. Adoption of this proposed ordinance, along with adoption of a similar ordinance by the City of Grover Beach, will standardize the weed abatement process within the Five Cities Fire Authority by providing both cities follow the same procedures followed by the community services districts. It also provides that the weed abatement process be administered by the authority. Community service districts are authorized by the government code to follow procedures in the health and safety code to abate weeds. Cities are authorized by the government code to adopt an ordinance to require the removal of noxious and dangerous weeds and can make the cost so that all three agencies that make up the Joint Powers Authority are using the same weed abatement process. The proposed ordinance will add a provision to the Arroyo Grande Municipal Code to provide for the adoption and incorporation by reference of the required health and safety code sections as an alternative weed abatement procedure for the City of Arroyo Grande and designate the Five Cities Fire Authority to implement its procedures. Staff is also coordinating with the City of Grover Beach to adopt a similar ordinance in their municipal code. The Grover Beach City Attorney is working with staff to have it scheduled in the near future. This concludes my staff report and would be happy to answer any questions that the Council may have. Thank you.
Questions for Mike?
No.
Go
ahead.
One question. In the staff report says the principal difference is that the proposed ordinance includes an optional procedure for collection of weed abatement charges on the tax roll after holding a required public hearing. So does that mean that if one property owner doesn't, if we abate his weeds and he doesn't pay us, we have a public hearing and to collect the money?
Well, the authority would conduct the hearing. And what happens is there's, in the City of Grover Beach and in the Oceana Community Services District, we go through three processes: the adoption of a resolution declaring weeds to be a nuisance and providing for weed abatement. Then there's another hearing called the weed abatement protest hearing. Then finally, there's a weed abatement cost and protest hearing. And we conduct each one of those
through the process, the weed abatement process. And so the final one, which you just described, is the weed abatement cost protest hearing. So that would be after the work was all done.
Right.
And then the person had the opportunity to, you know, either clean their weeds or they didn't do that. Then they could come to that last hearing and say, you know what, I don't think this was fair, or I don't think you did it properly, or I don't think whatever the reason that they had. And then we would discuss and figure out if there was a mistake on our part or not. Otherwise, if they did not pay the cost, mm-hmm. it would go to the tax roll.
Okay. Thank you for that.
So we're just trying to put it all under one umbrella mm-hmm. for rather than three separate weed abatement programs.
Yeah. Right. Makes one sense. Yep. Thank you.
Okay, so my quick question, Grover Beach hasn't passed this yet, right?
They haven't passed the portion, and maybe Tim could help me out here. They haven't passed a portion which allows the authority to be the administrator of all the process. So all those hearings I just described would be held at a five cities fire authority board hearing meeting.
Okay, so what about Oceano Community Service District?
We're also taking this to their board in March to allow.
Okay, so we're the first ones.
Correct.
Okay. What happens if the other two don't sign on?
Well,
just hypothetically.
We will continue to do it the same way we've been doing it in the past with three separate programs.
All right. This is not a public hearing, but anyone would like to come forward and comment on this item? Okay. Seeing none, we'll bring it back to the council. Start with Councilmember Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. This just makes a lot of sense to me. Five Cities Fire Authority has been establishing standards of practice and that will be uniform to all three jurisdictions. This will make it a little bit easier for the authority to continue to do the weed abatement program in a more efficient manner. I'll support this and recommend that my colleagues also support it.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Brown.
Well said, I agree.
Councilmember Barnidge.
Yes, I agree as well.
And Mayor Pro Tem.
I concur as well.
Okay, I'll make it unanimous. It's one of the reasons why we created the fire authority was for standardization. So this is a good example of it. I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Mayor, I'd move an ordinance of the City Council of the City of Aurora Grandy adding section 8.44-060 to chapter 8.44 of Title 8 of the Aurora Grandy Municipal Code relating to weed abatement.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Discussion. Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Barnidge?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Farrar?
Yes. Moving on to 11B, new business, continuing on, and consideration of funding agreement by and between the City of Aurora Grandy and the Housing Authority of the City of San Luis Obispo.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor and members of the Council. This is a project the City's been working on for probably 3 years now. It was coming together just at the time. It is close to transit, it is close to commercial areas, it's close to social services, and it's close to an elementary school. The agreement is for $600,000. The most of that funding will come from former RDA funds, which we are allowed to keep because the funding came from former housing bond proceeds, which have to be used for that purpose. Some of the funding also may come from the sale of the RDA loan that the City Council approved earlier in this meeting under the consent agenda. In order to protect the investment of the city, we've included a provision in the agreement that would allow the city to take ownership of the property if the Housing Authority has not made significant progress on the project within 5 years. I also wanted to point out to you another provision within the agreement that requires the city to issue and release a non-refundable deposit of $30,000 towards the project costs. And the reason for the need for that is that we cannot actually provide the funding for this project until July. And that's because
We've determined, due to state restrictions, that the funding must be first placed on the next ROPS, then it must be approved by the Oversight Board, and then it must be approved by the Department of Finance before they can release it for our use in July, which doesn't really make a lot of sense since housing monies are not supposed to be under the jurisdiction of the Oversight Board, but still they've come up with these regulations that make us go through that process, even though the city, as the housing authority successor, is supposed to have control over those monies. So anyways, I can tell you this is the first project that we have started to pursue since the elimination of the RDA, and I can tell you after going through it, the restrictions are so cumbersome that it makes it very difficult to do a project like this. We were fortunate in this case that we had three parties that were very committed to making this work, but it's still been a frustrating process as we find out how burdensome these new laws are. With that, we staff recommends respectfully recommends approval by the council of the funding agreement.
Okay, thank you. Questions for Steve?
I have a question.
Go ahead.
I'm assuming that's all deed restricted. Is that correct?
Yes, it will. It will be deed restricted at income levels that will comply with all the former RDA and current RDA and HCD requirements for use of these funds.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Any other questions? Steve, I just wanted to make sure that as we get closer to this, we consider some community workshops, a little bit of outreach in the community. Okay. All right. Once again, not a public hearing. Anyone would like to come forward on this, please? I knew there was a reason why you were hanging around here.
Nobody was going to sit voluntarily through all those other things unless they had some other business. So my name is Scott Smith. I'm representing the Housing Authority here tonight. I'm the executive director there. And actually appeared before you quite a few times about 18 months ago, right before I was, I worked for 28 years for People Self-Help Housing as the deputy director there, and I processed the Cortland project through you, many 1 a.m. evening meetings here trying to get that through. So I have a lot of experience working with the city. I processed through the Oak Forest apartments, the Juniper Street apartments here, the senior housing Quilty on Elm Street there. So I'm familiar with sort of the values the city holds, how they like to see things done, and the quality that they like to see long-term, and we're committed to that, too, as an organization. I commend the staff and the council, I think, for their vision on this, and we're committed to working with both the council and commissioners on the Planning Commission and the staff on shaping that vision as we go through this process. Timing, we'd like to get started on the architecture, retaining the architect, and starting the planning phases of it ASAP. This is a dismal time for financing for affordable projects. So, just like the redevelopment agency money is practically gone, I guess at this point, the funding from various state funds is gone completely. Those are monies that were created a few years back through Proposition 1C through a statewide ballot initiative, and all those funds have been spent. And federal cuts are pretty dramatic as well. So that's why we're saying, this could take 5 years to not to get it approved, but the funding timeline. Things are going to change, but we're going to work diligently on that, and we're committed to it. So with that,
for deed restricted affordable housing, and this fits a niche that we've never been able to quite get to. So if it comes to fruition, I'll be very excited, and I think we will hopefully start a path for other local communities to do the same thing. It really fits a particular need in our community, even more so as the economy's gotten bad. So I'm very excited about moving forward.
Okay. Councilmember Costello.
I, too, will support this tonight. Look forward to good improvement to the housing stock that we need.
Okay. Mayor Pro Tem.
Yeah, I do can support this. I do have a question for staff. Do we have to somehow deal with the $30,000? Because it's not in the initial part of the staff recommendation.
It's in the agreement.
It's in the agreement. Okay. So I support it as well. Thanks.
Okay, I'm ready to move forward as well with this, and I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Mayor, I would move approval of a funding agreement by and between the City of Aurora Grande and the Housing Authority of the City of San Luis Obispo on the above project.
All right, we have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
All right. Any discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Burnage?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. 11C, consideration of fiscal year 2013-14. This is the mid-year budget report. Deborah, good evening.
Good evening, Mayor, members of the council. I'm Debbie Malicote. I'm your Director of Administrative Services. Tonight I'm here to present to you the mid-year budget report. A quick overview. The purpose of the mid-year report is obviously to review where we are halfway through the fiscal year, kind of take a look at revenues and expenditures and see if there are any adjustments that need to be made. It also provides us an opportunity to give you an update on some of our departmental accomplishments. We do update the budget with the audited results from the prior fiscal year. And in the general fund, last year's ending fund balance was nearly $300,000 more than we thought it would be when we originally created the budget. So we do need to update those numbers. And while we look at every fund and operation that the city has, the mid-year report really does have a general fund focus. Overall, revenues are improving. It's good news. We have kind of an across-the-board recovery. Most major categories are seeing rebounding, if not to the previous pre-recession levels. We're getting very close. So sales and use taxes are rebounding. Property taxes are up. TOT is benefiting not only from the overall economic situation, but also from the efforts of the Tourism Business Improvement District. So we're seeing that effort paying off. The general fund is stable and it's strong, and we project that at the end of the year, the fund balance will be at 25% of appropriations, which is certainly good news compared to where we've been in the last couple of years, and the council's minimum fund balance policy of 20%. So that's a great item. There are a few minor adjustments that we need to make. Most of them are positive. And as far as making progress on our goals, we are making good progress in achieving those goals. Taking a quick look at the top 10 revenues, and again, these are in the general fund. With half of the year behind us, we're at about 39% of our revenues collected. That reflects the fact that most of our revenues don't come in incremental 1/12 every month. In fact, you see two kind of large zeros up there. And those triple flip payments come to us from the county in two payments, one in January, which we just received, and the other in June. So at the halfway point of the year, these numbers are consistent with prior year trends, although they are up from prior years as far as raw numbers. So that's good news. On the expenditure side, again, with half of the year spent, most departments are less than 50% expended on their budgets. Not everything happens, again, in equal increments throughout the year, but these trends are consistent with previous mid-year information. The two that you see that are 73% in non-departmental, that reflects the fact that we make a large one-time payment in July for our liability insurance premium. So that's a full year's premium, but we pay it all in July. So that kind of skews that number a little bit higher. And then the other is the city attorney's budget, and that's just due to ongoing litigation issues. We are recommending an adjustment to that budget, as was presented to you in the supplemental memo that you should have received. So with that, there are some mid-year expenditure requests. These are detailed in your report, and you see them on the screen. We are requesting the acceleration of $75,000 for the land use element update. We'd like to coordinate that with the next item, which is an East Grand Avenue development plan. We think that makes a lot of sense to coordinate those two efforts. Needs, and then the $20,000 for litigation services brings the general fund additional appropriations to just over almost $238,000 for the 13-14 fiscal year. And in addition, we're asking for $25,000 from the sewer fund to begin the reporting and monitoring program that they'll need to meet the state water Resources Control Board regulations. Yeah, we'll talk about that. The good news is that although we are increasing appropriations on the expenditure side, we are seeing revenues more than offset those expenditure requests. So the big ones here, obviously, property tax, sales tax, recreation fees, those are all coming in really well. In that other revenues category, this is, again, kind of a situation where we're taking what we thought was revenue that would occur in the second year of the biennial budget, the 14-15 year, and it's actually not going to be realized, but we have some additional revenues in 13-14 that are going to be realized. So they're not exactly dollar for dollar, but overall we are seeing increased revenues that more than offset our increased expenditures, and I haven't been able to say that for a long time. We also provide the council with an update on the goals that were developed and provided in the biennial budget. The report that is in front of you is organized by department, and it gives you a quick little ability to look through and see, are we ongoing? Have we completed the goal? Is it going to be revised in some way? We are making very good progress on achieving those goals. Couple of highlights. We did implement the Tourism Business Improvement District, and we are seeing a lot of results from that. I think even though it hasn't really gotten off the ground, its momentum is building, and so I think that's going to be very, very good for the hotels. We recently launched the new website, which we've had some great comments about. I think it looks great, and it provides us with a lot more ability to provide information to our constituents. So I think that's a great goal that the city clerk's department has recently achieved. There's been some good commercial development in the last year, Pier 1 and Panera Bread. We've seen an increase in the percentage of code enforcement cases that are being resolved quickly. We're in the process of addressing the police department's facility needs. They're going to be moving, as you know, in a couple of weeks here. We have an enhanced neighborhood services program. Some of you were able to attend the recent ribbon cutting for the Soto Sports Complex, ADA accessibility improvements, and as I mentioned, the increased participation in child care and other recreation programs. These are all goals that were set in the biennial budget, and we are happily achieving those goals. So the recommendation before you tonight is to approve the detailed budget adjustments that are listed in the report, to approve Schedule A as was revised in your supplemental memo, and to approve or deny the request for additional appropriations in the general fund and the sewer fund. And with that, I'll take any questions if you have any.
Okay. Questions for Debbie? All right. Any comments from the public? No? Okay. All right, then we'll bring it to the board and start with Councilmember Brown.
I'm ready to move forward.
Okay, thank you, Councilmember Costello.
I'm ready to move forward. I want to thank staff, particularly Debbie, for the work in getting to where we are. I know it started with the city manager and getting our house in order, and you've done a great job. Thank you all very much.
Okay. Councilmember Barnage.
Thank you. Yes, I'm ready to move forward as well.
All right, and Mayor Pro Tem.
Yeah, and I'm ready to move forward as well. Thanks.
Okay. This just getting easier than it was earlier this evening, but that's good news on the reserves, on the general fund reserves. I think that's at least 2 or 3% above what we were projecting earlier, so that's very, very good news. And I want to echo Councilmember Costello's comments as well. Well done on this report, Debbie. So good work. All right. I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Mayor, I move we approve the detailed budget adjustments listed in the mid-year budget report, the amended Schedule A as presented, and approve the request for additional appropriations in the general fund and sewer fund.
Second.
All right, we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Barnage?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. All right, moving on to item 12, Council Communications. Anything for the good of the order that we'd like to comment on. Property, who says that he has a signed lease, and the intent right now is to open as scheduled. That's all we know. So, subject to change. All right. Anything else? I have two quick questions or two quick comments. First of all, since we're doing so well on the budget, I think I mentioned this to you, Steve, before. It would be nice if we did revisit the – I don't want anybody throwing anything at me. If we did revisit the – take another look at our chair situation up here. I think we're sitting in 25-year-old chairs, so
And we have money. We still reserve the money in that budget, so it's in the budget. And take another stab at developing consensus on which chair we would like to buy.
I had the occasion to sit in some of the other chairs, and also had occasion to bottom out in those chairs. So I apologize to those of you. I think I have the most comfortable one, and but we need to get that changed. So, and then the other thing I wanted to echo Debbie's comments to Kelly on the web page. That's a heck of a nice job. You did very well with that. So, good work. Yeah. Okay. Moving on to item 13, staff communication. Anything, Steve?
Just to provide a brief update on the police building relocation, which is in full swing now. The police department is working very hard. So many details in terms of moving over to the Women's Club Community Center. Dispatch has moved over to the county sheriff's, and so they've been up for a week, and so far seems to be working well. Haven't had any significant problems. And then I believe the move date for the police department over to the community center from the existing police station is a week from Saturday, whatever that date is. 24th. Yeah. So just wanted you and all the community to be aware of that. You'll be seeing a lot of police staff packing boxes and moving from one building to the next. But a lot of people involved in the organization in that project. They've been coordinating very closely, and things seem to be going pretty smoothly at this point. And bids are out, which should be at council on March 11th to award the bids for the remodel.
Okay, very good. Item 14, community comments and suggestions. Not seeing any takers. We'll move to item 15, which is closed session. Once again, we would like to invite members of the public to come forward if they have any comments on the two closed session items that are published on the agenda. Seeing none, then the council will adjourn to closed session. And I should indicate to you that when we reconvene, we will make the announcement, if any, out of closed session on any reportable action at the next scheduled council meeting. All right, so council will adjourn to closed session at this time.